Life Management Science Labs would like to acknowledge that we live and produce this podcast on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. We'd also like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands of our listeners and our international colleagues. We'd like to pay our respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Work in Progress, the Personal Productivity Science Insights podcast produced by LMSL, the Life Management Science Labs. We are champions of life management science, providing structured insights informed by science and inspired by practice on key aspects of conscious living. Each week, we bring you scientific and practical insights on each element with the expert knowledge of professionals in the field. I am your host, Joanna. Let's get started. Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Joanna, and welcome back to Work in Progress, our personal productivity podcast. So today we're going to be talking about overcoming burnout in the workplace. And it's such a common thing that happens to a lot of people these days. So that's why we're going to be focusing on strategies to help reignite our passion and productivity at work. So to help me do this, I'll be joined by our guest, Marissa McCool. And Marissa is a former public health leader turned burnout coach for women in public health. She helps public health professionals reduce their stress, get more time, and create a fulfilling career without burning out. And she is also the host of the Redefining Rest podcast. So hi, Marissa. Thanks so much for coming onto our show today.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, of course. So before we get started with everything, I'd love to hear about your journey and how you got to the point that you are today. Like, what inspired this career path?
Yeah, so most of my career has been in public health. I worked mostly in sexual violence prevention or reproductive health, which, as I'm sure some folks listening can imagine, is a pretty strenuous job. Public health in general is, but those topics of sexual violence, reproductive health adds another layer. And I loved it. I worked in government settings and nonprofit and academia, but I hit a point well before the pandemic. The pandemic has increased burnout in the field a lot, but where I was burnt out. I'd get an email on the weekend and just start crying because I was so exhausted at the idea of getting another email. I was so resentful of the organization, not having enough funding, not having enough staff, and having so much work. My job at the time, it was just me doing what once was a job for three separate people because of budget cuts and turnover and things like that. And I just felt like there was nothing I could do. I tried all the productivity tips, right? Exercise, sleep, get the right calendar tool, but none of it resolved. I even went to therapy, which was great in a lot of ways, but it didn't really address my burnout personally. And I started working with a coach really on my mindset, on the ways I thought about productivity. I thought about work-life balance. I thought about rest. And that changed everything for me. And so when the pandemic hit, folks in public health were, you know, their workload, ours went up 2-3 times. And I was looking around and noticing like, oh, my experience of this is much different than my colleagues. Not because I'm a special snowflake, but I have all these coaching tools to help me manage my emotional experience, manage my nervous system, manage my mindset, set boundaries, say no, that they didn't have. So I started really thinking about providing that and becoming a coach for folks in my field. And it kind of just took off from there. And now I do that full time. I work with folks one-on-one for, you know, it varies how long we work together. Some folks 6 months, some 2 years, depending on where they're at. I also time to time host small, like 5-week courses for folks to just test out what it's like. And I've done some collaborations with public health organizations, trainings and webinars for their staff. So now I'm doing this full time, but I'm still supporting the workforce, you know, that I spent most of my career in.
Amazing. That sounds like such an extensive history of work that you've done there. I'd love to ask about the podcast that you're involved in. So tell me a bit about that. What are the topics that you deal with?
Yeah. So on the Redefining Rest podcast, it spans a large area. The concept of redefining rest is really the center of it, which is, you know, we've been taught directly and indirectly that rest is a reward, that rest is sleeping in and going on vacation. that rest comes after productivity. And that's our most people's viewpoint of rest. And the concept of redefining it is expanding it so much further, really ingraining the belief that rest is available to all of us, that it's our choice, that it's not an afterthought, and that it's a necessary piece of our day-to-day lives to have fulfillment, to have joy, and to avoid burnout. So there are episodes from What is Rest, talking about different types of rest, to burnout, to stress, to dealing with difficult people, and everything in between, mostly focused in the work realm, but you know, our work life, it doesn't exist in a vacuum outside of our personal life. So a lot of the clients I work with, you know, the same challenges they have at work come up at home as far as setting boundaries and feeling guilty for saying no. Maybe it's not to their boss, maybe it's to their mother-in-law or something like that. So it really spans the topic of like, how do we integrate rest in a sustainable way and recognize some of the barriers, including burnout and other people and our job and society and hustle culture and the patriarchy and many other factors.
Yeah, for sure. And I know that there's this big idea of feeling guilty about taking rest. So that's something I'd love to talk to you about. What do you think that kind of looks like when someone feels guilty for taking that time that they need to themselves?
Yeah, I really think that's an outcome of how we're socialized, right? Because a toddler doesn't feel guilty for taking a nap, right? Yeah. It's not something we're born feeling. I think we're taught that. And depending on your lived experience, your identities, you get different messages. So I find a lot of the people who feel the most guilt about taking rest are people socialized as women, are people who work in helping professions, are parents, are caregivers. Because the messages we get are, you have to serve everyone else. Putting yourself first is selfish. You must take care of everyone else. That's your value. That's your worth. And so then we feel guilty if we prioritize ourselves at all, because consciously or not, we have that internal dialogue and belief going on. Where there are other people, like my partner who's socialized as a male, he doesn't have guilt for spending a whole day watching sports or Netflix, right? He doesn't have the same experience because he wasn't taught the same thing. So I think part of the guilt comes from that place of what we've been taught, of what we should be doing and who we should be. I also think most people also get similar messaging from hustle culture. In modern society, it's like, in order to be successful, you have to do it all. You have to do it all perfectly. You have to get all the accolades. And that only people, the people with success are the people who worked really hard and didn't take a break. You can find so many examples of people online who are like, I got rich by waking up at 3 a.m. and hustling and grinding. And at the same time, there's people who are getting up at 3 a.m. because they have to work three jobs to just afford rent.
Yeah.
So we get those messages too, that you shouldn't rest, you can't rest. Like, in order to afford to live or to have insane success, you have to overwork. And I don't think that's true, but I think that internal narrative really drives that guilt we feel.
100%. I feel like even personally, when I am taking that time to rest, like I'm watching Netflix, I'm like, oh, let me just check my emails. Let me try get on top of that while I'm trying to rest. And it's so hard because it's like this internal battle of like, I need to rest, but I also feel like bad for doing that because I should and I can be doing something more productive. But I guess that comes down to redefining what productivity means, I guess.
Yeah. And I think that's the other place we've gotten a lot of messages about productivity. We've been taught, I think most people don't realize this, but that productivity creates your feelings. Like, the more productive you are, the happier you will be, the more you'll feel good.
Yeah.
But that's not true. We've all had days where we don't do anything and we feel totally fine about it. Or where we only do one thing and we still feel proud. So it's not like the act of doing and getting a number things on your checklist done create your feelings. We've also been told that like productivity should be on this pedestal, that that's like the key to happiness and fulfillment. And I can't tell you how many people I've coached who are later in their career who come to me and say, I got all the degrees, I got, you know, the C-level suite job, I got the salary and the house and this, and I'm so unfulfilled, so unhappy. And that's because doing it all and being super productive doesn't create our fulfillment or our joy. So we've kind of been taught that productivity and rest either are fighting against each other, or productivity must come first in order to earn your rest. And I don't think that's true. So dismantling that is a big part of getting rid of the guilt and that internal battle in our head, which many of us feel, right? Sitting down to read a book and it's like, well, you should be really doing the dishes right now, or you still have laundry in the dryer that you need to get out, or, you know, Sarah needs a response to your email, and it's just ongoing in our head.
Yeah, 100%. I totally agree with that. And I'd love to get more into that when we get to our little interview bit. But for now, I'd love to jump into our section that we've called Have You Met Marissa? So here we're just going to get to know you a bit more before we get into like the nitty gritty of everything. So my first question for you is, are you reading anything at the moment, or do you have a favorite book?
So I am reading Emotional Labor. I wrote down the author because I knew I'd forget, Rose Hackman. It's really good. I haven't finished it, but this concept of emotional labor, I think, is very vague, even to me. And so reading this book has given me so much nuance and language around what that is, how it impacts my life and other women, particularly women's lives. So I'm not done with it yet, but it's that good that even though I'm not finished, I would recommend it.
I love that. I feel like there are some books where you have to get to the end of it and then you can be like, okay, that was a good book. But the fact that it's a good book already, like, that must be a really good recommendation. So thank you so much for that one. My next question for you is about movies. Is there anything that you're watching at the moment, or do you have a favorite movie?
You know, I'm not big into movies.
Okay.
But I love TV and I'm not caught up, but The Great British Bake Off is like my favorite rest experience. Like, it just puts me in the best mood. I'm really behind, but yeah.
Oh, I love The Great British Bake Off. I went through this entire phase because I was in America like last year, and on Netflix here in Australia, we don't have The Great British Bake Off, I don't think. So while I was over there, I literally watched it nonstop for like 4 months straight. But it's like my favorite show. It's like the best show to just sit down and just like totally forget about everything and just like focus on these little people baking. Like, it's so fun.
I know. And I really hate that the shows aren't available everywhere, because there's an Australian show I really like, Doghouse Australia. It's like about rescue dogs, and they match them with families. It's so heartwarming. We saw it on TV when we were in the UK, and I tried to find it here and we could not find it. And I was so sad.
I know. I hate that, because now I can't watch it. And it's literally one of my favorite shows. But I'm so glad you mentioned The Great British Bake Off. I feel like it's so underrated.
I love it. It's just like, puts you in a good mood. So if you do have access to it, check it out.
100%. Totally recommend. Awesome. So my next question for you is, obviously you're a podcast host, but do you have a podcast that you like listening to?
I do. It's pretty off topic, but my favorite murder.
Ooh, true crime.
Yeah. You know, I don't listen to other true crime podcasts, but I like the host and the way they talk about things. And if for folks who've listened to the podcast, listeners write in like hometown stories, which aren't all murder. Some of them are funny and different things. So yeah, it's what I listen to when I walk my dog, just to like, because otherwise my podcast list is all self-development and coaching, which it's like, you got to have some space from your own work. So that's my go-to.
100%. I love true crime. There's this one I used to listen to a lot called Red Handed. I'm not sure if you've heard of it.
Is that about the missing Indigenous women?
So they do a lot of different cases. So they might have done one about that. But there are a couple of British women who host the show. But highly recommend. It's really good.
Okay, cool. I'll check it out.
Yeah, perfect. And my last question for you is, do you have a famous role model or even just anyone in your life that you look up to?
You know, one of my current favorites right now is Huda Katan. She's the founder of Huda Beauty. And without getting into detail, you know, she's really modeling leadership as far as standing up for your beliefs and your values, even if it costs you business, which I think in our capitalistic world, a lot of times decisions are made more about keeping money and profit. And so watching her in such her big platform use her voice, it's just been really inspiring. So Oh, my mother-in-law asked for my Christmas list. I was like, Huda Beauty, here's all the products I want.
I love that. Beautiful. Well, thank you so much for sharing those ones with me. Let's jump into our interview questions for today. So my first one for you is, how would you personally define burnout in the context of like the work and workplace?
Yeah, I'm also glad you said in the context of work, because I think it's important to acknowledge you can have burnout in different spaces. There's a lot of people have parenting burnout or caregiver burnout, right? So it's not just work, even though sometimes we think of it that way. And there's not a universal definition. I think a lot of people go to thinking of, someone working on the front lines, like nurses during the COVID pandemic, or someone like being so overworked they faint and go to the ER. And those definitely can be cases, but it's so individual. I love the definition from the book Burnout, which I highly recommend too. I give it to all my clients, by Amelia and Emily Nagoski. And they describe it as being stuck in exhaustion, which I thought was such a good visual. And for some folks, exhaustion is the right term. For me, when I was burnout, I was stuck in resentment. But most people, I find they're stuck in some sort of emotion that they can't really get out of. And I think that comes from, constantly over time working beyond your mental, emotional, and or physical capacity. And I think that stems a lot from the messaging we were talking about, which is rest is a reward. You have to get it all done. So then we end up overworking, which doesn't necessarily mean the hours in the day. It's just like, what is your mental, emotional, physical capacity? Someone might be fine working 10 hours and someone else 5 hours is at their capacity. I think we've kind of been sold this idea that everyone should have the same capacity. Like, think about the 9-to-5 structure. That promotes this idea that everyone should be able to work those hours. That's their best hours for their, deep thinking, their capacity, that they should be able to work that many hours. But that's not true. Depending on your physical ability or the way your brain functions, someone with a neurodiverse brain is going to have different productivity needs and capacity than someone with a neurotypical brain. So I think knowing your own limits and not working past them is a big part of preventing burnout. But what gets us to burnout is not doing that and just constantly working past those capacity limits.
Yeah, and you mentioned like this idea of exhaustion, and for you it was resentment. So what are some of those like symptoms? Like, what do they look like physically or emotionally, for example?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it does vary person to person, but here are some common ones I've seen.
Yeah.
One is emotional reactions to things being disproportionate to what happened. So for my example I used earlier, where I would cry when I get an email on the weekend. It's understandable I would be upset, but for me personally, that level of emotional reaction was disproportionate to like what the email was asking. Mm. Same thing, I've seen this with my clients where they might get interrupted by a colleague and all of a sudden their emotions are turned up real high and they're really angry and it's just disproportionate to what happened. So that can be a sign. Struggle sleeping can be a big sign. Of course, there could be other reasons people are struggling with sleeping. So this is where it can be tricky to like tease out what's going on. A consistent lack of motivation. I met with a new client yesterday who had recently left a toxic job and went to a new organization that was really supportive, promoted work-life balance, but she's still struggling. And as she's talking about her challenges, one of the things was, I'm just not motivated at all to work out, to work towards my goals. Like, I have zero motivation. And as we were talking, I was like, I think you're experiencing burnout. And it hadn't even occurred to her because she thought, oh, I'm in a better work environment. Like, that can't be happening. But that might not be true. And of course, lack of motivation, depending, that could be a sign of or symptom of depression. So like, it's not a clear-cut checklist necessarily. But there are some things that you can look out for as far as your physical symptoms. Like for me, my psoriasis got really bad. That's inflamed by stress. Emotional, like noticing if you are just only feeling negative emotions and even something that normally you'd be able to enjoy, you can't. Again, could be other things that are outside of the realm of coaching, But that's why it can be helpful if you are struggling to meet with someone, whether it's a coach or a therapist or someone else, to determine what's going on and how can I move through this.
Yeah, for sure. And for people who might not have access to someone that they can turn to, what's the best way to, you know, work through this? So they've identified that what they're going through could be burnout. So what are some of the first steps that they could take to, you know, help themselves?
Yeah, I think a great way is there's lots of books and podcasts as a great starting point. And that's actually where I started too. And most of the people I end up working with start as well, right? Because at least most podcasts are free. So that's a great free resource. And some of them, including mine, have transcripts. So if you'd rather read or can only read, books also, like Burnout, the book I mentioned earlier, is a great starting point because it helps set the stage for what burnout is. And it talks a lot about the nervous system, because a lot of what burnout is our nervous system is constantly activated and heightened. And we're in a constant fight, flight, or freeze response, which for folks listening who might not be familiar, our psychological stress response is an important part of our physiology, right? So if we're going to get hit by a bus, we want our physiological stress system to kick in to get us out of that danger. It's a safety mechanism. But a lot of times with burnout, we're stuck in that cycle when we're not in physical danger and it's hard to get out of it and it's burning so much mental and emotional energy. So the book Burnout, but many others talk about the stress system and how to slow the stress cycle and process emotion. So I would say those are some good places for folks to start. Then the next piece, the actual things that I find most people need to work on is setting boundaries and sticking to them, learning how to say no with confidence, and stop people pleasing, which I know all three of those are difficult. I'm not going to pretend like they're easy, but those are things I have found most often folks need to work on in order to start to move out of burnout and prevent future burnout.
Awesome. And with this idea of like setting boundaries, what are some examples? And what does that kind of look like? Is this setting boundaries with people or like yourself?
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked this because I think we think a boundary is, hey, I drew this line in the sand, you can't cross it. And then someone crosses it and we're like, they disrespected my boundary. But that really sets you up for disappointment because you can't control other people. A boundary is not for someone else. A boundary is for you. It's outlining what you are or are not going to do. It's not about dictating what someone else should or shouldn't do. So a workplace example would be, I see a lot of times people are like, I told my team not to email me at 5 p.m. and they kept emailing me. I'm like, of course they did. They're going to keep doing what they're going to do. You can't control them. That's not a boundary. A boundary is I'm not going to check emails after 5 p.m. or I'm not going to respond to emails. So no matter if they're emailing me, my boundary is what I'm doing. I'm choosing not to. So I think it's important to understand what a boundary is before you set one. It's not about manipulating other people and what they're doing. It's about what you're choosing to do to support yourself. Other people might not like it. They might be upset. That's okay, right? That's where the people pleasing can get us into trouble because we want to please them. We don't want them to dislike us. So then we kind of drop our boundary.
Amazing. And I love how you talked about the fact that a boundary is not for other people, because I feel like when we talk about boundaries, we often think of it in like the context of trying to control other people and how they sort of respond to us. And like, I feel like that's why mostly, for example, I haven't been able to stick to boundaries, because if someone crosses that boundary, I'm like, oh, it didn't work because they're not listening to that boundary. So I'm like, maybe boundaries don't work for me. So I'm glad you made that distinction about boundaries being for yourself.
Yeah. I mean, I think wouldn't it be lovely if we could make boundaries for other people and they just followed them, right? Yeah. If I knew how to do that, I'd be a billionaire. Yeah. But that's not the way it works, right? And in truth, no one wants to be told what to do, right? So if someone else is trying to force you to do something, you wouldn't like it either. It doesn't get us anywhere. And when you set a boundary appropriately, which means it's about you and what you're going to do, that also means you need to take responsibility, which I think a lot of us want to avoid. It's easy to blame our job, to blame our boss, to blame the government, whatever the external things are that are challenges. I'm not denying that. But when we set a boundary for ourselves, that's taking responsibility over where we have control and agency. And that's what we have capacity to do. That's where we have control. We have decision-making power. We have agency. We can't force other people to do or say certain things. And I think sometimes that's where folks struggle setting boundaries because we want to avoid taking that responsibility for ourselves.
Yeah, amazing. Well, thank you for talking about that and covering that. I'd love to come back to that. But first, I'd love to move on to talking about like satisfaction and increasing our satisfaction in our jobs. So how does overcoming burnout contribute to that?
Yeah, one of the biggest things when you're burnt out is most people are pretty unfulfilled, whether the burnout's in work or in another setting, because when you are exhausted and burnt out, like I like to think of it like this. If you're a visual learner like me, imagine your body has a cylinder tank in it for your emotions. If it's completely full of like resentment and shame and guilt and exhaustion, there's no space in that tank for joy or fulfillment or pride or confidence. And so there's just not space for it. But when you get out of burnout and you reduce, you're not stuck in those emotions. It's not like they disappear. Negative emotions are a part of life, but you reduce them. They can flow in and out. There's space for those other experiences, the joy, the fulfillment, feeling like you have a purpose, happiness. So you have more space for that emotionally, but also in your calendar typically, because when you are saying no, when you are setting boundaries, you have time to step away for lunch. You have time to try a ceramics class. You have time to be present with your family at dinner. So I think in general, life fulfillment goes up, and then career fulfillment, a lot of times what happens is folks realize either that they've been stuck in their career because their burnout wouldn't let them move forward to what they really wanted, or they finally had the confidence to really be honest about what they really want and might be completely different than the career that they're currently in, and to have the courage to do that, whether it's go back to school or start a business. So I think it opens up fulfillment in a lot of ways.
Yeah. And I guess coming to this point of feeling a sense of job satisfaction and fulfillment is a big journey. So what are some of the challenges people might face when they're trying to overcome burnout and they're trying to get to that more satisfying stage of their career?
I think one of the biggest ones is believing that fulfillment comes from external things. That your fulfillment is determined by who your boss is or what's on your to-do list or where you live. Now, those things matter. I'm not denying that, but fulfillment is really an inside job. So you can feel fulfilled in your job, even if you kind of have a not great boss. You can feel fulfilled in your life, even if your job is kind of boring, right? I think we constantly are seeking the external thing to give us fulfillment, and it's really the internal piece. And I think the other thing that's important to note for listeners is your fulfillment, some people's fulfillment or purpose in life doesn't come from their career, and that's okay. We've kind of been taught this idea that everyone has a purpose and it's always related to what they should have their career in and make money from. But that's not necessarily true. There's lots of people who are happy to be in a job that pays the bills, and then their purpose and fulfillment comes from their family, comes from traveling, comes from their hobbies. So just to make clear for folks that like if your purpose and fulfillment, even after you get out of burnout, isn't something that, you know, you really create for yourself in your job, it's okay. You can create it in another area in your life.
Yeah, beautiful. And how do people go about finding that? So for example, they've been so set on this idea that they're supposed to find fulfillment in their career, but they're realizing that that's not where it's coming from. How do they go about, you know, seeking that from other places or knowing where that comes from?
Yeah, I find most people deep down, especially once they kind of start getting out of burnout, they're better able to name what their true desires are or their true passions. I think as we get older, like kids, They know what their passions are. They know what they're interested in. They don't need to go find it, right? They figure it out on, you know, they might get exposure, but it's not like a big life soul-searching experience for them. And I think we lose that as we get older. And so I think a lot of times, if you're on the journey to get out of burnout, there's a lot of self-growth, creating confidence, questioning what you want, getting to know yourself. And part of what comes out of that is what's already inside you. It's is you know to some level some of your desires, what you want, what you're interested in. It's more about creating the confidence to make that a bigger part of your life. Whether it's, I've had clients who are like, I'm going to quit my job and go back to school to become a therapist. Or clients who are like, I'm going to reduce my hours to 80% and I'm going to spend more time with my kids. I think there, obviously there are people who soul search and they have a great experience. And obviously we need to be exposed to some things to know if we like it. But I think for most people, there are some things that they already know deep down they want or desire or enjoy. It's just creating the confidence and the time and the capacity to make that a bigger part of their life.
Yeah, 100%. And I feel like sometimes it can be hard to do that. Like, for example, you said increasing your work hours to 80% so you can spend more time with your kids. I feel like that's such a big step because on one hand, you're sacrificing work and hours and potential money that you could be getting, but in order to achieve something that's greater than financial success, for example. So how do you go about being okay with, you know, sacrificing a part of something in order to gain something else?
Yeah. And I just want to point out the word sacrifice you use is very fascinating, right? Because it sounds, right? It's so devastating almost or like intense. But I think if we step back and remember that there is no perfect choice, there's no perfect situation, right? So it's not necessarily, I mean, I don't think of it as a sacrifice. I think of it more as a give and take. Yeah. With every decision, there is a give and take, but we still have a choice. We have a choice to work full time and maybe not spend as much time with our kids. We have a choice to go down 80%, spend more time with our kids, but make less money. It's just a give and take. And there's no right or wrong. It's about what's right for you. And everyone's decision and answer to that question would be different because the factors matter differently to them. So I think that changing the way we think about it, about like, okay, what am I getting and what am I letting go of? And knowing that no matter what decision I make, I'm getting something and I'm letting go of something. Like that's going to happen no matter your choice. There's not like a perfect choice where you get it all. I haven't found that yet.
Yeah, amazing. I think that's a really great way to put it, like giving and taking it. I feel like it has less of a negative connotation than sacrifice does.
Well, and so it's less pressure, right? Because when you say sacrifice, you're just like, oh my gosh, you know, there's more pressure on it. But thinking about it as like a give and take, it kind of takes the pressure down a little bit. It doesn't diminish the importance of some of those factors, but it doesn't make it so scary to make that decision. And I think our survival brains do like to go to worst case scenario, like, oh my gosh, if I go down to 80%, I'm going to lose this much income. And then what if I spend too much money? And then what if I can't pay my bills? And our brains want to go there. Yeah. But if we take it down to it's a give or take, it's not the end of the world. It changes how you go about the decision.
Yeah, for sure. And for those people who have been stuck in like doing things a certain way and haven't taken that time to, you know, reevaluate, you know, this concept of like giving and taking and what's important to them, how can they find a space where they're okay with taking that time to reevaluate what they need?
Yeah. And I think you can do it in small ways every day, right? You know, there's some people, they might go to a 10-day retreat and get that. That's not accessible to everyone.
Yeah.
So it might be listening to a podcast episode on your walk and you're starting to think about things a little differently. It might be journaling one day about, okay, where am I at? Where do I want to be? Where was I last year? It might be a conversation with a friend about what do we want out of life, right? So I think a lot of times the self-development field in which I am now kind of does give this idea of like, instant overnight transformation. And that, you know, those intensives where you hire a coach or go on a week retreat, that's great. But it doesn't have to be that way. It can be day to day. And maybe it takes longer, but that's okay. You're still growing through it. I think there's this rush to the finish line, but you build a house brick by brick. Those bricks matter. So it's okay if every day you're just laying one brick down.
Yeah, perfect. And I feel like it's important to emphasize that it can be a journey and it doesn't have to be like an overnight thing, especially for people who might not be able to, you know, have the resources to be able to afford to do a 10-day retreat or hire a coach or a therapist. It's really important to emphasize that there are other ways to get to this point that doesn't involve all these extensive resources as well.
Yeah, it's more like DIY. There's books, there's podcasts, even conversations with people. There's so many coaches, and now more therapists also have like free courses or worksheets to download. So there, it just is, you know, it just takes some time and intentionality for you to do that.
Yeah, for sure. Well, thank you for sharing that with us. And I'd love to jump into that self-care side of things as well, because I noticed we've talked about like journaling and that type of thing. So how can self-care come into, you know, overcoming burnout?
Yeah, I think it depends how you define self-care. So I think a lot of times self-care is kind of portrayed as like getting a pedicure or going to get a massage. And those things are great, but typically those are the things we do every once in a while as a treat to ourselves. But if you think of the word self-care, it's really caring for yourself. And the truth is, all of us are doing that already to some capacity. You are eating food, you are drinking water, you are maybe going outside, and you're maybe getting sleep. So I think a better question is, where on the day-to-day could you care for yourself a little bit more? Is it taking breaks to eat your lunch? Is it spending 10 more minutes with your kid after school? Is it going for a brief walk? Instead of the like every once in a while treat myself self-care concept, which, listen, I love my facials, so I'm not digging at that, but what's the day-to-day ways that you're already caring for yourself, which you are, and what are the ways that you're not, but you could be? And that helps sustain your mental, emotional, and physical capacity. That is a form of rest. That helps prevent overworking and burnout. So I think we need to be, and not we as in just you and me, but like society-wise, needs to be a little bit careful about how we talk about self-care and what it is, because I think it leans so much to, you know, it being a treat and a luxury, when really it's about the day-to-day ways we really take care of ourselves.
Yeah, for sure. I can totally relate to that, because I feel like when we talk about self-care, we might talk about the luxurious things, like let me book in a facial, but the like realistically, we can't be having like facials every week unless, of course, you can afford that. But
I wish.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like the average person probably can't, and it's unrealistic to expect that you can. So those everyday ways are very important. Would you be able to suggest some more, you know, little everyday sort of things that we could do?
Yeah, and I will say it's very personal, right? Because for one person, waking up 30 minutes earlier to have some alone time might be a form of self-care. And for someone else, getting that 30 minutes of sleep is more of a form of self-care for themselves. So I think it's just important to note that you have to figure out what works for you and what's caring for you. And it might change day to day, week to week, depending on what's going on, the context, how busy you are, what are the challenges you're facing. But I do think it's really important to figure out what for you is a form of daily self-care. So for me, just use me as an example, I never work through my lunch. I always step away to eat my lunch. Now, pre-burnout or during burnout, I worked through my lunch every single day. So I've just made the decision that's a form of self-care every day I'm doing. I move my body a couple times a week. I connect with friends. I do listen to podcasts. So things like that. But folks need to figure out what ways can you care for yourself on the day-to-day? And it doesn't have to be, this is really important. I think sometimes like New Year's is such a good example. New Year's resolutions, everyone makes them as if their life is going to change overnight. Yep. That is so disruptive. That completely, and this is why we don't keep them. It's just so disruptive. It's not about disrupting your life, it's about integrating more rest into your life. So maybe it's not 30 minutes of reading a day, maybe it's 10 minutes of reading once a week. Figuring out what's one thing you can do that integrates into your life, and then over time as it builds as a habit, you can increase the amount or the frequency. But I'd encourage folks to start with, everyone listening probably has one or two things where they're like, oh, I really wish I could do that. And I'm not talking like, oh, I wish I could go see Adele in concert. I'm more talking when you're like, oh, I really wish you see your colleague, they leave work early and you're like, I wish I could do that sometimes. Or, you know, your partner goes relax and takes the bath. You're like, I really wish I could do that every once in a while. Those are some things that you could start to integrate as daily self-care or weekly or monthly self-care.
Yeah. And I'm so glad you brought up this whole thing of New Year's resolutions, because I feel like everyone just waits for like the New Year's day to roll around and they're like, okay, this is the day I'm going to actually start doing things for myself. And then you give it like a week and they've already forgotten about what they set for themselves. So I feel like it's so important to take accountability for what you want to change in your life and not just wait for, you know, a tradition of, you know, New Year's resolutions to force that upon you. So how can we go about being accountable for doing those things? Like, for example, you talked about maybe taking some time to read 10 minutes a week. How do we stay accountable to do that?
Yeah. And there's creative ways, and depends on what's best for you, right? I think for a lot of folks, accountability is easier when someone else is involved or you're paying for something. Like I know it wasn't until I signed up for workout classes that I really got my butt to the gym because I paid for it. So it depends for you. So I know some folks who have Goodreads and they track their reading in there, and that's a motivator. Over the summer, me and my two best friends formed an accountability group for working out and texted each other after we worked out and motivated each other. So think about some of the things that might be helpful for motivation. And it's not about doing it perfectly, but it's about helping you build progress. Is it telling your partner what you're going to do and asking them to help you stay accountable? Is it asking friends if they want to do it with you? Is there an app that helps you track? But I think no matter what it is, the best thing you can do to set yourself up for success is to set a reasonable, doable goal, something you can integrate, something that if something changes in your life last minute, that you can move it around. So 10 minutes once a week, if the day I had planned to do that, all of a sudden, oh no, our oven went out, we have to like go out to dinner, I can move that 10 minutes to a different day. Versus 30 minutes a day, just starting out, you're going to have lots of disruptions every day. That's going to be hard to juggle and move around and get used to. So I think really setting a goal that's feasible that you can integrate is the best thing you can do for your success.
Yeah. And how do we stop ourselves from feeling bad if that reasonable goal is literally only 10 minutes a week of reading?
I'm so glad you asked this. I'm actually teaching a productivity class right now. And one of the things I say in the goal setting week is if your brain says it's not enough, it's the right goal.
Okay, because interesting.
Your brain's going to want to be like, that's not enough, that's too small, that doesn't count. Then you know it's the right goal for you, because what it means is it's a doable goal. It's something you can like achieve, even if that means you don't do it every week because life happens. It is something you can achieve. And pride is so much more motivating than shame. So if you have a goal that's doable, that you're able to achieve maybe 80, 70% of the time, that is going to keep you going. That's going to give you natural momentum and motivation to keep going, right? Positive reinforcement. Versus setting yourself up where you can achieve it, then you feel shame for not getting it done, which shuts us down and stops us from continuing to try. It's like negative reinforcement. So if you start smaller, I know our brains protest this, you actually have a higher chance of succeeding and then continuing on and even growing because you have that momentum and you feel good about it.
Yeah, I feel like that's such a useful thing, because me, like, I know if I told myself, okay, 10 minutes a week of reading, my mind would be like, that's not enough, you can do more. So then it would turn into like 30 minutes of reading every single day for the week. And then I get to those days and I'm like, this is too much. I thought I could do it, exactly. But you know what? I can't do it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So just expect your brain's going to do that. And if it is, you've chosen a good goal, a good baseline goal to start from. And just remind yourself, once whatever your timeline is, 3 months, whatever, once I get there, I can change it if I want. It's not permanent.
Yeah, beautiful. Well, considering all these factors that we've talked about, like different mindsets, strategies, you know, self-care, how can this all come together to help reignite our passion for our work and find a sense of purpose at work?
Well, I think a big piece is once you shift your mindset and actually process some of the emotions you're stuck in, and also start prioritizing time for yourself and doing things that you've been wanting to do. And what you will notice is that, well, it's like the pride being a motivator thing. You will have more joy and fulfillment in your life from that. Because just seeing, it's human nature. When we do something, there is a sense of pride that comes from it. It might not last forever, but they're like, humans aren't a species that like to be idle, right? We do like it sometimes, but for the most part, our species have always been like a doing species. So as you do and make those changes, I think that alone can bring fulfillment for folks. But then even from there, you notice and you find fulfillment in the day-to-day stuff that you didn't before because it was smothered by resentment, by shame, by frustration, by exhaustion. And maybe for some folks, it's like, well, what I'm realizing is actually, I think I would find more fulfillment in this job or this field or being a stay-at-home parent or whatever it may be.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel like that sort of thought process is really important, and being able to consider all these different things that we've talked about and how they can be like fuel to help you get to the point that you want to be at is very important as well.
I think it's also important to remember, like, this is a lifelong journey. I think we think like, oh, fulfillment and purpose is just like a destination we have to get to. But that's not true. Like, it is a journey. There's going to be points in your life where you have more joy and fulfillment and you have less. Where you have more challenges and you have fewer challenges. That's just what life is. Life is 50-50. Half of it is really hard and difficult. Half of it is beautiful and joyous and great. And that's the equation it will always be. So it's not like, oh, let's go find enlightenment. Let's go find the light at the end of the tunnel, the gold at the end of the rainbow. It's, no, this is a lifelong journey. How can I move through it? And as in my journey, have spaces of joy and fulfillment and recognize there are also going to be challenges along the way. And it's not a race to the end.
Yeah, amazing. Well, thank you so much for sharing that with us. And I'd love to jump into our next section, which is our practices and habits debrief. So here we're just going to focus on maybe just one practice that you would specifically recommend to help people prevent or manage their job burnout. So is there something that you can suggest for us?
Yeah, and I wrote down a bunch, but I will pick just one. I think one of the best ones, especially if you're in burnout or you're really stressed to start with, is write down a list of what's out of your control and what's in your control. So a lot of times our brains want to focus on the things that are out of our control. How many emails are in our inbox, like are getting sent to us, what our boss says, the new policy at work. And we want to focus there, which can create a lot of stress and resentment and resistance because we might not have a lot of agency or power to change those external things. And that can really lead us to feeling disempowered and like things are out of our control and there's nothing we can do and hopeless. But if you make a list of what's out of your control and then you follow it up by making a list of what's in your control, which might be challenging at first, but if you push your brain to do it, I guarantee you that your list of what's in your control is going to be way longer because you have agency over when you reply to an email, when you check an email, what you say in that email, how do you respond to getting interrupted, when you eat your lunch, right? And obviously, depending on your job, there are differences on the context and legalities and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, you have choice, you have free will. So what's in your control is actually a lot. And if you do this anchored to a specific situation that you're frustrated with or struggling with, what you'll find is you'll have a lot more in your control than you're giving yourself credit for. You have decision-making power, you have agency, and you'll feel more empowered. It's not denying the challenges, but it's redirecting to you to what you could do or what you could choose not to do, and having that agency. So if you're in burnout or stress, I would recommend you trying to do that when you are feeling activated by something happening at work, and just see what happens when you do that, when you separate those two.
Yeah. And what are some of the challenges that might come along with this practice?
I think one challenge is those listening are probably going to be like, I don't have time for that, which is not true. It can just take a couple minutes, right? But that's going to be a challenge, your brain telling you you don't have time. I think another challenge is thinking of the things you do have control in, because your brain probably wants to believe that's not true. Mm. Probably because our brains want to avoid taking responsibility. Our brain's motivation is to avoid pain, conserve energy, and seek pleasure.
Yeah.
So when we are not taking responsibility of where we have control, that's a form of conserving energy and sometimes avoiding pain. So making that list of what's in your control might be a bit of a challenge. And then throughout the day, even if you do that activity, your brain will probably continually go back to what's out of your control. Oh, I can't believe he said so-and-so. Oh, they shouldn't be emailing me. Oh, your brain's going to keep doing that, of course, because that's what it has been doing. But you can redirect and look back at that list of like, okay, what's in my control in this situation? What can I do? What are the choices I have?
Yeah, for sure. And what happens when you decide to put this into practice, and how does that impact your productivity once you decide to consider these factors?
Oh my gosh. In so many ways. We waste so much time, mental and emotional energy on things we can't control. So sometimes it looks like writing 10 emails trying to get someone to change when we can't force them to change. You could be using that time and be like, I'm going to let them be them. I'm going to work on this report I need to get done by Friday. So it actually frees up a lot of your mental and emotional space and time to focus on the things that you need to do for your job, rather than spinning your wheels, trying to change something that you might not be able to change. So a lot of times, you know, when folks are focused on what they can't control, they're in resentment or frustration, they will shut down. They might not do their work at all. They might scroll Facebook or the news. They might reread the email they're upset about 10 times. They might go vent to a colleague for an hour, right? And this is very human. This is not to shame anyone. But all of that reduces our efficiency and effectiveness to getting our work done, to reducing our to-do list, where if you're able to let go of what's out of your control, doesn't mean you have to like it, but to let it go, you can use that time and energy to follow your calendar, to check stuff off your to-do list, to stay focused on what you're working on.
Yeah, 100%. And I feel like that whole thing of letting go and not giving into those tendencies of, to, for example, what you said, rereading that email that made you feel frustrated. So how do we stop ourselves from doing that? Like, we know what we can't control, but we keep revisiting it and we keep re-aggravating ourselves about that.
Yeah. I would ask yourself, why? Why are you revisiting it? What are you hoping to get out of that? And the answer might be different for everyone. I think a lot of folks, they want to feel justified. They want to feel righteous, right? Or we want to feel heard or validated. But naming that's what you're seeking and then recognizing, I'm not going to get it from reading this email 10 times. I'm not going to get it from venting. Maybe my coworker will agree with me, but that doesn't make my feelings go away. So I think naming why you're doing that and what you're seeking. Okay, if you're seeking validation, if you're seeking to be heard, how can you hear yourself? How can you validate yourself and not need someone else to do that? If you're seeking justice or righteousness, how can you give that to yourself without, you know, forcing someone else to do it who's not going to do it?
Yeah, I feel like that's such an important point. And what happens to like your feelings when you stop giving into that? How does that increase your productivity?
Yeah. So almost every action we take is either driven by an emotion we're feeling or to chase an emotion we want to feel. So when you are feeling resentful or frustrated, your actions from that are going to be dictated by what you're feeling. If you're able to shift those emotions, not feel them as much, process them, let them go, there's space for another emotion that might be more helpful. right? Think about when you are the most productive or you get the most done. What is the emotion driving that? Usually it's not resentment. Some people, they do like, they are anger productivity people. So like anger fuels their productivity. So everyone's different. But like for me, it's more like committed, determined, excited. When I'm feeling shame or guilt, I do not want to get work done. I shut down. So I think what happens when you let go is it gives space for another emotion that actually is more helpful to driving the actions you want to take to get your work done.
Yeah, beautiful. I'm so glad we brought up this whole like point of focusing on like the emotions and realizing that we shouldn't keep harping on things that aren't productive for us, because the more we keep doing that, the less productive we're going to be and the less able we are to focus and work towards the things that are more important to us.
Yeah, and you're not going to feel good either, which also is important.
Yeah, 100%. Thank you so much for addressing that. I feel like that's such an important point. So that brings us now to our questions from the audience. We've got a few here for you, but my first one for you is, how can individuals rediscover their passion if they've lost it due to burnout or, you know, other factors?
Okay. My answers are going to be a little bit more coachy on these ones.
That's okay.
Okay. Because it's interesting that the question asker used the word lost as if I lost my purse or I lost my glasses. And I think that implies that it's something you can lose and it just goes somewhere into the abyss. And that puts you at such a disadvantage to create fulfillment and passion in your life. It's not something that's given to you or you buy. It's something you create. And if you create it, you don't lose it. It's still there. There might be things blocking it or smothering it, but it's still there. And maybe the passion has changed or the fulfillment or the purpose has changed. That's okay. But I actually would encourage folks to practice shifting out of, oh, I've lost it, because that implies you need to go find it. And that feels like a lot of work and our brains don't want to do that, to what if I still have passion and fulfillment? What would it be? What if I still had purpose? What would it be? What if I have it right now? I'm just not seeing it or feeling it. And notice how it puts you more in the present rather than having to do work to go to the future.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess that's a really hard thing to do, to, you know, focus on what's ahead as opposed to what you're stuck in at the moment, because I feel like it can be so easy to just remain stuck in this cycle of what you're in at the moment.
Yeah. But what if there's something under that, right? Mm. Like, what if the passion is under that feeling of stuck?
Yeah.
Because then what does that drive you to do? It drives you to get unstuck and get the support to get unstuck, which is very different than going on a goose chase hunt to find some sort of like elusive fulfillment that's out in the world that we lost.
Yeah. So I guess it's about really identifying what's important to you, whether or not you want to be stuck in this spot forever, or if you actually want to find, like what you said, what's underneath that.
Yeah. Yeah. And like there is, even if you're stuck, we all get stuck at points. Just because you're stuck or burnt out doesn't mean you've lost your passion or fulfillment. It's like, if I have a purse and my favorite lipstick is in my purse, but now all of a sudden my partner's put a bunch of junk in my purse, we're going to a game, my friends put their stuff in there, my lipstick's still in there. There's just a lot of other junk in there too. Mm. I don't have to go buy a new lipstick. I don't have to go, you know, retrace my steps. It's still there. I just need to unpack what's going on top of it.
Yeah, 100%. I love that analogy. I feel like it's so perfect for this. So thank you for that. So my next question for you is, what are the unique challenges faced by early career professionals and how can they protect themselves from burnout?
Yeah, I think the biggest one that comes to mind is imposter syndrome, which I think many folks are familiar with that term. But those of you who aren't, the way I describe it is it's that little voice in your head that says, oh, I'm not good enough, or I shouldn't speak up. Like they're all smarter than me. Maybe they hired me by mistake. Like it's that voice. And the truth is, no matter your career development, people experience imposter syndrome. I think it's a big thing when you're early in your career because the context matches the voice in your head. You are new. You are just starting out. But I will tell you, I've coached so many people who are late career who still have imposter syndrome, yet their context has changed. They have 200 publications. They have a senior level position, but they still have that voice in their head. And that's because imposter syndrome doesn't come from how many years of experience you have or your degrees. It's that internalized narrative we've gotten from white supremacy, hustle culture, the patriarchy, that we're not good enough, that we shouldn't speak up, that we're not smart enough. And that's the voice. And that's one of the biggest challenges, especially early career, to apply for jobs, to put yourself up for a promotion, to speak up at meetings, to promote your idea, to take initiative, to volunteer to lead a committee. And so part of the work to address that is to change that narrative in your head. Practice believing that you are smart enough, that you are good enough, that you do have something to offer.
Yeah, for sure. Perfect. Well, my last question for you is, how can managers and leaders create an environment that supports their team members' well-being, passion, and productivity?
Okay. This might be the answer might not be what managers and leaders want to hear, but I think it's really important. You have to lead by example, which means if you want to create an environment where your staff have work-life balance, where they don't burn out, where they do prioritize joy, you have to do that yourself. And what I find so often is managers say, oh, I want to create an environment. I tell my staff all the time, take time off, don't work through your lunch, but then they're working while they're traveling. They're writing emails at 10 p.m., so you have to model the environment you want to create for your team by implementing that into your life, into your work schedule. Not only just because your staff will better be able to believe that what you say is what you mean, right? Because we've all had parents say, like our parents growing up tell us we can't do something and then they go do it. Doesn't make us want to not do it, right?
Yeah.
Same thing with leaders and managers. So it helps build rapport and trust. It helps communicate to your team you're serious about what you're willing to do for them and the environment you're creating, but it also helps you be a better leader because you'll be less reactive, you'll be able to listen more actively and respond to concerns and think more creatively. When we're burnt out, when we're exhausted, we can't problem solve very well. We can't think creatively. We jump task to task, we get distracted, right? So when you're able to undo that, you can think clearly, you can problem solve, you can be innovative, you can be more collaborative, you can be more responsive, even when things are really challenging, because there are big challenges managers and leaders face.
Yeah, for sure. And I feel like leading by example is such a great emphasis, because you can't be something if you can't see it materialize outside of you. So having those examples shows you what it could look like if you were to achieve that yourself.
Yeah.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for sharing all that with us. It now brings us to our last section for today, which is our open mic. So I'd love to hand it over to you to talk about just anything that you would like to.
Sure. And this, I was thinking about this, was like, do I go really off the wall and just totally left field, or do I keep it a little tied? So I'm going to go in the middle, which is, you know, one of the best things I've learned in my journey, especially with self-development and coaching and burnout, is how to, and I'm not perfect at it, let me be very, very clear, but how to accept other people as they are, even if they differ from me or I disagree with them. I think a lot of times, you know, if we have, like, for example, my mom smokes cigarettes. I hate it. I hate cigarettes. But to be able to accept that she does that without villainizing her, and without forcing her to change, has given me so much peace in my life. And one of the areas that has allowed me to do that is, for the past 5 years, I've been vegan. And I've taken on veganism as, it's my choice. It's no one else's choice. My partner's not vegan. I have no vegan friends. No one in my family is vegan. It is my choice. And practicing that, and practicing, I'm not trying to force you to change your eating habits. I'm not trying to lecture you on why I choose the eating habits I do, and accepting them and accepting our differences, I've been able to say, oh, why can I do it with veganism? And why in this area am I struggling to accept them for having a different point of view or disagreeing with me or for doing something I don't like? And When you work, it's a lifelong practice, let me tell you. But when you do the work to accept a situation or someone else, even if you disagree or even if you don't like it, and just get to a place of acceptance, it releases so much. Accepting is not the same as condoning, right? So I don't necessarily condone my mom smoking, but I accept it. Yeah. And that's really so much angst for me. And so I think about that example, like, where is an area in your life you're able to do whatever you're trying to do? How can you transfer that somewhere else? If you're able to be patient with your toddler, how can you transfer that patience to working with your direct that you're trying to manage?
Yeah.
And just see where the parallels are in your life and where they differ and question why and see if you can bring them along.
Yeah, perfect. I'm really glad you brought this up as well, because I feel like it's so hard when someone else has differing values or beliefs to you, and you find that sometimes it has to result in conflict or it has to result in, you know, an unnecessary tension. But I feel like going through that process that you talked about and coming to terms with it in a way that doesn't have to be like, oh, you do this, therefore I don't like you because I don't do this. It's very important.
Yeah. And sometimes you come to acceptance and still choose not to have a relationship. Like recently, took me many years to get to a place of acceptance from a friend I had, partner, who I don't agree with a lot and in many ways don't like. But I got to a place of acceptance. And from there, I made the decision, I don't want to be friends with them anymore. Mm-hmm. I didn't villainize them. I didn't say they were the problem. They're making me. I also didn't make me a bad person for ending that friendship. Mm-hmm. So sometimes acceptance means continue a relationship with that person, like with my mom, but sometimes it means, no, I'm gonna let go. But you're letting go not from resentment and pointing a finger, from like true acceptance. So purpose of acceptance isn't to agree with everything or to keep everyone around. It's to get to a place where you can make a clear decision of what's right for you without emotional drama and exhaustion and unnecessary weight to it.
Yeah, 100%. Well, I'm so happy that we've talked about so many different things today and that you've brought this one up as well, because I feel like it all results towards productivity, because even though what we're talking about right now isn't directly related to workplace productivity, it can be related to personal productivity and just your personal life as well. So that's perfect. So thank you so much.
Yeah.
Awesome. So that brings us to the end of today's episode. But for those of us who want to find out a bit more about you, where can they go?
Yeah, you can head to the Redefining Rest podcast wherever you listen. It's available, and check it out. You can also connect with me on LinkedIn if you're active there. I'm very active, just Marissa McCool, or my website, mccoolcoaching.com. And I'm guessing some of those links will be in the show notes. And I'd love to connect. If you're listening and you find any of this insightful or you have questions or challenges, feel free to reach out.
Perfect. Well, we've also got Marissa's details down in the description below if you missed that. But to everyone watching, thanks so much for tuning in, and we'll see you next time. You have been listening to Work in Progress, the Personal Productivity Science Insights podcast produced by the Life Management Science Labs. Listen to episodes from LMSL's 10 Life Management Perspectives on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or other podcasting apps on your smartphone. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider rating our show, sharing it, and subscribing to our channel, as it helps other people find it and us grow to bring you more quality resources. More of our work can be found on our website, pp.lmsl.net, where you can join our movement. I'm Joanna. Thanks for tuning in.